The Fairbanks Dog Mushers Association will be holding their first race of the season this Sunday, both unlimited and seven dog classes. 18 teams are scheduled to compete in the 10-mile open class, and another 20 will be going out in the seven. A Spirit of the Wind style neck-and-neck finish isn't expected. For one thing, George Atla isn't racing in this one, but the man he narrowly defeated in the Fur Rendezvous race shown in the film will be in the contest, Gareth Wright. And he'll be going out of the chute number one, breaking trail for the teams to follow. A few weeks ago, when there hadn't been much snow on the ground and most local mushers were complaining about the lack of training their teams were getting, I asked him about his dogs and prospects for the racing season.
Well, basically, they're looking good, but they're all young. They're mostly about a year and a half old. They're a year this spring, you know, June and July pops. But then I feel they'll probably do fairly well because I trained them most of the summer, the first time I've ever done that.
What'd you do?
Well, I just trained them on a three-wheeled Honda, and So I ran them just 2.5 miles, but that over the period of the summer, I ran about average of 4 times a week. So when you add that up by 5 months, it ends up about 200 miles, which usually you don't even have on the dogs till January.
He'd hook up as many as 10 dogs at a time to pull the Honda, and some days he'd run 5 teams. But even with that advanced training, Wright isn't expecting them to hit their peak for a while.
In 1981 is the schedule for them to be able to be really top competitive in the main races, you know.
We've got, 48 dogs now, you said?
Yeah, about 48 or 50 of dogs.
And how many of those are pups and what kind of ages?
Well, they're about half pups and half dogs that are, well, there's 4 or 5 that are, you know, really too old, 8, 9-year-old dogs, and then the ones that are, there's some 2 to 4-year-old dogs there. But so those 3.5, 4-year-old dogs will be still okay in by a year and a half from now, actually, it would be. But these dogs this year, that's pretty young to expect them to race 3 days in like the Rendezvous or North America.
Though he doesn't expect to win those big races, he will be running.
I'll be running all the races to give them training, and I mean, if I'm not running, I'll have someone running. You know.
For all of his disclaimers about the age and inexperience of the dogs, he isn't exactly expecting a string of red lanterns, traditionally awarded to the last place finisher.
I figure to be in the money a little bit, too.
If you think he's boasting, beware. Gareth Wright won both the Anchorage Fur Rendezvous and Fairbanks North American Championship races in 1950, the Fur Rendy again in 1957, and in recent years he's been no slouch either. In 1973, he came in second in the Fur Rendy race over both Doc Lombard and George Atla, and he placed fourth in that same race the following year. 1973 was also the first year his daughter Roxy won the Women's Fur Rendy Championship, and his grandson Ramey beat out all competitors in the one-dog class of the Junior North American Championship. Right now, his niece, Amy Bargdahl, she came in second to Roxy in the North American last year, is training up his dogs. It's a sort of dog-mushing dynasty. But how about other people interested in learning about dogs and getting into racing? People who don't have Gareth Wright for a close relative.
Well, the best recommendation is to get, first of all, take and get with a known breed of dogs that's been, you know, somebody that has dogs that have been proving that they're in the top, and then get started with the best. In other words, don't start with just a dog off the street, because all you're going to do is spend money feeding it and have disappointments. And then for a young man, then if he can take and spend time like with known mushers that have done well, and talk with them and, you know, listen to them and realize that they got where they were because they had the experience that the young people are just now going through, and if they can be saved one step through the whole process there, it's going to put them ahead faster.
Though Gareth Wright refers to mushers as he, it's not because he discounts women. Quite the contrary, given how well his two female protégés have done. Actually, as he says,
I still haven't found a good protégé in a man yet. I'm still looking for one.
Well, if you're looking to start mushing, maybe now you'll have some idea of where and with whom to begin. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Residents of an area comprising one-fourth of the entire Fairbanks North Star borough are seeking detachment, or secession, depending on which term you prefer. The Salcha area starts approximately 30 miles south of downtown Fairbanks, along the Richardson Highway, just past Eielson Air Force Base, and stretches down the road along the Tanana River and on up to the headwaters of the Good Pasture and Salcha drainages. The area's residents are an independent bunch of dog mushers, trappers, farmers, teachers, and seasonal construction workers who want less government and don't want to pay for the borough government they've got and the services they say they're not getting. Pump Station 8 is in the Salcha District, assessed by the state at $127 million, and private property adds another $19 million of assessed value. Altogether, that gives more than $1 million in property taxes to the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Petitions signed by over 200 of the approximately 300 resident voters last week will soon be mailed to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. Once they review the documents to determine that they are in order, they will be sent on to the state's Boundary Commission. If, after public hearings, the commission rules against detachment, that ends the matter. And the Boundary Commission has never approved such a request. The residents of Eagle River near Anchorage and part of Kenai have tried. However, if the request does go through, then it's up to the legislature. They've got 45 days or until the end of the session, whichever comes first, to make up their minds. No decision means the Boundary Commission's recommendation holds. Several Salcha residents are in the forefront of the movement to secede. Jerry Gustafson, who lives at 46 Mile Richardson Highway and is a shop teacher at North Pole Junior Senior High School, is a member of the Salcha Secession Committee. He outlines some of the arguments used for detachment.
We feel we have a different type of community out there. It's essentially a rural type of community, whereas most of the rest of the borough we feel is urban or suburban. There are some exceptions. We're not geographically contiguous because we have Eielson Air Force Base, which is essentially a no man's land insofar as the civilian population is concerned between us and the rest of the borough. And we're just not offered very many services, nor are we interested in having very many services offered to us out there. We have the school. There's a grade school there that's run by the borough, and the high school students go to Eielson Air Force Base, which is currently a borough school also. Of course, the schools in the borough are state-funded primarily anyway, so we feel that the only services we really need out there are the schools and the some sort of sanitation service, which the borough is providing in the form of a dumpster that many people feel is kind of inadequate. But we feel that we could do better, probably do that cheaper. You know, we could provide that ourselves. So we're trying to set up our own government, probably a third-class borough.
Why a third-class borough?
Well, basically because we've been talking this over at meetings, and a lot of people out there feel that they want minimal government. The idea would be best, you know, no government, but you can't operate that way. And it's been made known to us that the various factions within the state are interested in not having any such thing as an unorganized area within the state. And there's been some hint, in fact, that the legislature may go ahead and organize all of the unorganized areas into some governmental units anyway. So we feel that by becoming a third-class borough, we will have some control over our own destiny that way.
What powers does a third-class borough have?
Basically, a third-class borough can run schools. The borough assembly serves as a school board. It's basically a school board. It does deal with other things that come up, but anything that is to be done, if Salcha became a third-class borough, and if a group of people somewhere in Salcha wanted a fire, you know, fire protection, they would organize into a service district. They would decide whether they wanted the thing, and then they'd pay for it, basically, you know. So it wouldn't be a situation like we've got in Fairbanks now, where through our taxes out there, we're subsidizing the borough bus transportation services. You know, we don't get use of those things.
Vacant, unappropriated state land within the Fairbanks North Star Borough is now being selected, and a good chunk, better than one-fourth of those selections, lie within the Salcha precinct. Given their plans for separation, Salcha residents have a strategy to prevent the transfer of lands within their boundaries.
What we're going to request is that an injunction be put into effect to stop the borough getting title to these, the North Star Borough, until the question of our detachment is settled.
Officials of the North Star Borough just seem to aggravate the Salcha folks.
The latest thing that got this going was last spring, the borough tried to implement what they call their comprehensive community plan, and they came out with some planners to the Salcha area, and they had a community meeting there, and basically this community plan was that we were expected to come up with some sort of a plan for the future of the community insofar as, you know, if we wanted zoning, what type of zoning we wanted, and various types of things like that. And the people that attended the meeting, and they had several of these, I think about three meetings, and told the planners that came out that We were doing fine. We didn't expect any large population influx. We don't have very heavy population density, and we didn't feel we needed any of this planning at this time. We would like to, you know, have let the status quo prevail, and we were essentially, got the idea anyway, that they didn't think that that could be done, that we would have to come up with some sort of a plan. Well, that's upset quite a few people, you know, that the borough should be dictating to us that we have to come up with a plan, even though the people in the area didn't feel that any plan was needed at this point.
Though the movement for detachment is off to a strong start, signatures of only 10% of the area's registered voters were required on the petition, and around 66% signed up. Taking the case further is another matter. One question is whether it's possible to bring the issue before the next session of the legislature, provided the Boundary Commission gives a recommendation favorable to Salter residents. If the 1980 session is missed, borough land selections of state land will complicate matters. The North Star Borough has until October of 1980 to make its selections, and with that inroad, area residents fear their chances for detachment would be minimal. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
Welcome to the joint federal-state Beaufort Sea Sale. It's my pleasure to be here this morning to join with officials of the state of Alaska in conducting this historic sale. The sale represents the first federal lease sale in Arctic waters, the first sale in which the federal government has joined with any state in offering oil and gas leases, as provided under Section 7 of the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act.
At 10 a.m. sharp, Alaska OCS Manager Esther Wunicki opened yesterday's Beaufort Sea oil and gas lease sale in Fairbanks. Governor Hammond, who had planned to attend, was ill, and Attorney General Avram Gross read his remarks to the hundreds of people in attendance. He stated that this was a significant event for Alaska.
Alaska already is considered a major oil producer, having contributed approximately 12% of the entire United States production in 1979, primarily from a single field, Prudhoe Bay. The potential to increase this production by discoveries in the Beaufort Sea is great. We enter this sale with more knowledge about the geology and with more technical information than ever before available to the state.
Bids on federal tracts, tracts 1 through 45, were read first.
I'll begin the reading of the bids by first announcing the tract number, the number of bids received on that tract, the names of the companies bidding, the approximate percentage of each company in a combined bid, the total amount of the bid, and the amount bid per hectare.
Tract 1 received two bids.
The first bid is a joint bid of Chevron USA Incorporated with 50% and Phillips Petroleum Company with 50%. The total bid is $1,537,405. The amount per hectare, $1,680.97. The second bid is a joint bid of Shell Oil Company with 50%, Atlantic Richfield Company with 40%, Murphy Oil Corporation with 10%. The total amount of the bid is $3,037,000. The price per hectare, $3,320.61.
High bids totaling $491,728,137.60 were submitted for the 25 federally managed tracts that received bids. The highest was for Tract 37, just south of four state-managed disputed tracts near Dinkum Sands. That joint bid, submitted by Atlantic Richfield, Union Oil Company of California, and Exxon Corporation, was for $143,089,000. On some tracts, there were no bidders, on others but one, and six bids were received for one tract, Tract 25, a federally managed disputed tract. All told, there were 62 bids from 11 of the 44 approved bidders.
I would like to give you a brief resume of the procedures that will follow with respect to the federal tracts. There will be an adjudication of the bids, there will be an evaluation of the bids with the U.S. Geological Survey. There will be a transmittal to the Secretary of the Interior for a final decision. The Department of Justice has 30 days within which to review the bids with respect to their competitiveness, and the Department of the Interior has 30 days from the ruling of the Department of Justice within which to issue the leases.
After a short break, Commissioner of Natural Resources Robert Loresch took the podium to read the bids on state tracts.
The way I'm going to announce the state bids are a bit different from the way Esther announced the federal bids. We'll do it like the Miss America contest. We'll announce the bids in ascending order. And then I will point out whom the apparent high bidder is. But of course, everyone realizes that that has no legal significance. It's just apparent from what was written on the unadjudicated bid form.
Bids on state tracts and state-managed disputed tracts began with number 46, a net share profits tract in which the tract is awarded to the bidder offering the highest percentage of the net profits from any production on the tract. Six bids were received for that first state tract offered, though four other tracts, 47, 57, 63, and 76, received seven bids apiece, but none topped the 93.2% net profit share offered by Amerada Hess for tract 69, only slightly higher than their apparent winning bid of 93.02% offered for that first tract, 46. As with the federal tracts, not all state tracts were bid on either.
The next three tracts, tracts 58, 59, and 60, received no bids.
Net profit share bidding had never been used before in a speculative sale in the United States. The system gives the state both immediate cash and a 20% or more share of production, plus a share of the producer's profits. 26 tracts were offered for sale by the net profit system, but bids were received for only 18 of them, though they were considered among the most promising pieces. Bid ranges were wide. Tract 63, under the bonus bid system, is an example. There were seven bidders.
The first bid came from a group made up 40% of James L. Thurman, 40% of Brian R. Berglund, and 20% of Cliff Berglund. Total bonus offered was $25,257.40.
Contrast that with the apparent winning bid for that tract, Union Oil's offer of $16,400,387.54. After all state bids were in and read and the oil company executives had marked their maps and tally sheets, there was a report on the day's financial activities.
Money exposed on the federal tracts, $945,445,102.41. Once again, the total high bid, $491,728,137.60.
Then there were the state totals. First, the Dinkum Sands and fixed bonuses from the net profit share bidding tracts.
The total apparent high bids totaled $567,391,497.98. That's the state only. The state and federal apparent high bids added together, that is bonuses only, total $1,059,119,635.02. Okay, the total money exposed in the state sale, $1,146,977,802.42, for a total exposure in the both state and federal sales of $2,092,422,904.83.
Some companies expressed displeasure with the net profit share bidding system, notably Exxon, but nevertheless, they bid on and will apparently receive a number of tracts. Bob Dempsey, a close follower of petrochemical activity in Alaska, made this observation about Exxon.
You notice they did not bid on or high percentage on those areas over there. They did bid very high in the bonus area on Flaxman Island, where they have been doing a lot of exploration work. So I think we can be confident that there is a significant amount of oil in Flaxman Island.
I also asked him about the showing made by independents and smaller companies like Amerada Hess.
They did well in the net bonus bidding situation, where they give a part of the net profit. I think it reflects their size in the industry and that they're able to do that. You notice over in those areas that the major operators did not bid as high on a net profit share, which indicates their need for a greater return, internal rate of return on the money to service those large corporations. So I think Amerada Hess is very, very fortunate, and I think you're going to see them do very well up there.
What is the difference between a bonus bid and a net profit share?
The bonus bid is you give a significant amount of money up front and then have a fixed royalty on the backside through the entire life of the field. For example, Prudhoe Bay, the state of Alaska, has 1/8 or 12.5% of everything that comes out of there. This net profit share enables other companies to bid, for example, like Amerada Hess, who cannot come up with great amounts of hundreds of millions of dollars up front, but is willing to gamble and say that when the field starts producing and the net money starts coming in other words, their investment has been paid off, they will then in turn give a greater portion of the net profits to the state. If you went to the traditional method of bidding, we probably would have easily been over $3 billion. In this case, the total amount of money exposed was $2.1 billion, with a significant amount of the tracts under this new bidding proposal. So I think there's no question that this is the largest lease sale ever held.
It may be the biggest sale ever held. That remains to be seen. And it also remains to be seen whether history and what type of history will be made. Roger Herrera, Alaska Exploration Representative for Suhio Petroleum, explains.
Whether we're making history will be determined by what happens in the next 4 or 5 years and whether exploration is successful. If it is, this sale will be deemed historic. If it's not, people will quickly forget it.
Of course, there are those January 3rd and February 19th federal and state court dates and decisions to come. Lots more before and if exploration and drilling and history occurs. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. It was something like the old game show, the $64,000 question. The question being whose bid was the highest on each of the 116 tracts at today's joint federal-state Beaufort Sea oil and gas lease sale in Fairbanks. But unlike game show contestants, there were few displays of emotion, with some exceptions. Like the first time a figure in the tens of millions was read off. That was Exxon and Union Oil's joint bid of $53,139,000 for Federal Tract 35. That got oohs and ahs, subdued ones that grew considerably when the highest bid on any of the federally managed tracts was read off by Alaska OCS manager Esther Wanicki. A $143,089,000 bid by a consortium of Atlantic Richfield, Exxon, and Union Oil for Tract 37, which, like Tract 35, was among the federally managed disputed tracts. And there were some laughs, too, again for Exxon, this time because of a bid many millions of dollars lower than the others. But people at Exxon probably feel mixed emotions, since others of their bids, apparently winning ones, if they're accepted, were much higher than the closest competition, as on State Tract 110, when their bonus bid was $85,689,000, $20,269,000 higher than the next highest of the other five bidders. All told, bids on state and federal tracts totaled $2,092,422,904.83. The highest net profit share bid on a state tract was 93.2% by Amerada Hess on the first of the state tracts offered, number 46. After the phew died down, Commissioner of Natural Resources Robert Loresh, who read the offers on state tracts, remarked in reference to criticisms concerning the bidding method that it, quote, doesn't seem like a bad bidding method so far. Both he and Wanicki seemed to have a certain feeling of relief about them. Now they were finally doing what all those months, years for some, of preparation had been leading up to. Though Wanicki read the high bids first, Loresh reversed the order, like in the Miss America pageant, he said, a remark that drew no boos in the almost entirely male audience. Regardless of the relative restraint in the behavior, and especially the expressions of the people gathered for the event, there was a certain sense of excitement. Roger Herrera, Alaska Exploration Representative for Suhio Petroleum, felt that the excitement level before the sale was quite high. As he explained,
This is the, since the 1969 sale, this is the biggest oil event in Alaska, without doubt, I think. And not only that, but times have changed since 1969, and there's a great dearth of good acreage for oil and gas exploration left in North America. So this is perceived as one of the last chances to get a foothold in a very prospective area.
In spite of that chance for a foothold, no bids were received on 19 of the federal and 9 of the state-managed tracts. But some independents did get their chance, picking up state tracts for very low bids. One was just a little over $14,000, in areas surrounded by tracts that had gone for millions. After all the bids had been received and Loresh gave his last remarks, some staffers donned yellow t-shirts proclaiming, quote, "I made it through the Beaufort lease sale." Alaska OCS manager Esther Wanicki felt much the same way.
I feel like it was a successful sale, and I'm very relieved. Go home and go to bed tonight.
For lots of people, it'll be party time first, but then there will be that formidable engineering problem of how to get the oil out of those often very expensive tracts. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. More members of the press than Big Oil were in evidence at the Travelers Inn in Fairbanks this morning, site of the joint federal-state Beaufort Sea oil and gas lease sale. But that may reflect the press's high profile and the desire for the bidders to hide their intentions right until the bid envelopes are opened. Tomorrow morning, bids will be accepted until half an hour before the 10 o'clock start of the sale. The bids that have already been received for state tracts have all been in white legal-size envelopes, according to Pete Nelson, leasing manager for the Division of Minerals and Energy Management of the State Department of Natural Resources. But they don't have to be like that, and she expects to see some more clandestine behavior tomorrow.
What they normally do is camouflage their the fact that they're bidding, as well as the number of bids, and certainly what tracks, until they actually have to submit them through the lobby of the hotel, and that they want them camouflaged.
116 tracks will be up for bid, some owned by the state, others, approximately 17%, owned by the federal government, and another 17% whose ownership, state or federal, is disputed. Bids on the federally owned tracts will be opened first tomorrow morning, and the 44 approved bidders will see how their calculations compare with the other people who snuck through the lobby, envelopes or whatever in hand. Esther Wanicki, manager of the Alaska OCS office in Anchorage, will be opening those envelopes. I asked her how she felt about tomorrow.
I think it's an exciting day and an important day.
Do you feel that this is anything like the ceremonies for the Academy Awards?
You mean, hand me the envelope, please, and so forth? I hadn't thought about that. I suppose there might be some corollary.
Though it isn't the Academy Awards, there was a certain guarded anticipation in the air. A crew from West German television circled about, a team from KUAC-TV was setting up for tomorrow's broadcast of the event, and there was a mock run-through of procedures.
Can you describe what's going to go on tomorrow morning?
Well, tomorrow morning until 9:30, we'll continue to receive bids on both state and federal tracts. We have a dual team in the workroom, and they'll receive the bids and place them in the track folders. And then promptly at 10 o'clock, we'll begin. And the governor, I understand, is going to be here, and he'll have some remarks. And we'll introduce the people who are participating, and then we'll give a brief history of how we happen to have the first joint federal-state lease sale in the history of the entire OCS program. And then we'll begin to read the bids. And I'll read all the federal bids, and then at that conclusion, there'll be a little pause while we total up things for the federal side and switch some of the staff people, because then the state staff people will take over behind the podium, and Commissioner Liberish then will read all the state bids again, if they're allowed to go ahead.
It had been estimated at one time that the entire process would take 2 hours. How does that look now?
I think 2 hours is a good guess. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take long to read bids. I need to be very slow and deliberate. I understand I have a tendency to talk very rapidly.
And numbers are rather important.
And numbers are very important, and I've learned to look to the far left for those digits, too.
Aside from the money involved when all those digits are read and tallied, Wanicki thinks there's much to be learned, not only from tomorrow's activities, the culmination of many months of planning and negotiating, but from the events that will follow the sale.
I think the things that will be learned if everything goes forward and if there is indeed a sale and there is indeed exploration in the Beaufort will be things that will inform people before they begin to think about drilling in the Chukchi and the North Bering.
Esther Wanicki, manager for the Alaska OCS office, the person who will be the first to open those sealed bid envelopes for the Beaufort Sea lease sale tomorrow. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.